Welcome to the Humanist Union of Madison monthly meeting. Our speaker today is Randy Converse, who was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. Randy?
Thank you. I want to thank Humanist Union for giving me the opportunity to tell you about my journey. My journey to pacifism with a lot of help from humanism. What I do a lot is I like to make some definitions before I start, so we all know what I'm relating to when we talk about it. Humanism, this is from the Humanist Three Manifesto. One, humanism is a progressive philosophy of life without supernaturalism, which affirms our abilities and responsibilities to lead ethical lives of personal fulfillment that aspire to a greater good of humanity. That's our working definition today for humanism. Pacifism, my definition of war is groups of people engaged in armed conflict in which many, many people are killed. Pacifists, particularly me, believe that war is never justified. There's no war that ever has or ever will be that is ever justified. So my journey began when I was in college, about 1969. I was a junior in college, a place called Denison University in Granville, Ohio, which if no one has ever heard of that place, it's a little outside of Columbus. It's a liberal arts school, four-year liberal arts establishment. And I was a psychology major back then, and I was living in my own little world, working hard to get this degree to become a therapist. And somehow that bubble broke. I think it was probably because the black students on campus were making demands about more relevant curriculums and more involvement in the school outer world, particularly as vis-a-vis the black people of the community. And then through that little hole created my awareness there's something horrific happening in Vietnam. And I said to myself, how can a therapist do anything to deal with all these issues? So I decided to become a minister. And I thought, well, that would be a way that I could be a therapist, do pastoral counseling, and address these larger issues. Okay, well, one problem. I didn't go to church. I was a Catholic when I was younger, and my mother, when I was in junior high, gave me permission to stay or go to church, and I decided not to go to church. And when I went to college, I went to church a couple times, but that kind of went out the way of all most college students' work in terms of religion. I didn't go. So I said, what am I going to do? That summer, I decided to go to church. And there was a liberal Protestant establishment, the United Church of Christ establishment, in Wilton, Connecticut, where I was living at the time, and my parents were living there too. And I decided to get to know people, and I was kind of impressed with how they talked about. They talked more about relationships and the larger world, social justice issues, and I thought, this is kind of interesting. So I took the bold step of asking them, well, in order to become a minister back then, you had to be sponsored by an established church. So for some reason, I had the courage, after cultivating these short-term relationships, say, hey, could you sponsor me to go to divinity school? And they, in their generosity, said, sure, we'll do it. So I went back to school, all happy that I've decided to go to become a minister. And then, guess what? Back then, there was a draft. And I got my number. And my number was very low. So I was going to be drafted. So I said, well, what am I going to do now? I can't go to divinity school if I'm going to be drafted. Well, back then, again, I was lucky. If you were going to minister or in divinity school, you got a deferment. So I said, great. So I did my homework and got all my applications in and got accepted to a place in Boston called Andover Newton Theological School. It was, as I reflect on it, it was a liberal Protestant school. And I think to this day, they still train folks who enter the UU ministry. And they, at one time, a few years ago, I believe they were going to partnership with Mead Lombard and a joint effort because they're both struggling financially, and it never came to pass. But anyway, there's a UU connection there. So as I went there, again, I liked the talk, you know, talked about people and social concerns. And then I began to realize that, again, my point of view, that they were talking about a personal God, and that was okay, you know, but it was a God who kind of set things in motion, and it was ultimately up to people to decide how to live their lives and how to deal with the world. And I said, that didn't make any sense, you know. Why put your energies into talking about God and what he or she or it would do for you when it didn't really matter? What really mattered is your work as an individual human being and those folks, the other human beings in the world. So I was obviously very increasingly uncomfortable with this. And so how could I be a minister, you know, with talking about God and how I saw God being talked about in this liberal congregation? So guess what? I decided to leave divinity school. Okay, Randy, you just left divinity school. Well, you're going to be drafted. So now what are you going to do? Of course, because of my beginning beliefs about Vietnam and the horrific nature of that encounter, I couldn't go into that situation. So I said, well, I'll become a conscientious objector. Why not? Well, and there's two kinds of conscientious objectors. One, that you sign up and get drafted and you do service, called alternative service, and the Army, Air Force, whatever branch of the armed services you sign up for, you don't need to hold a gun. And then there's another kind of alternative service in which you create, with the help of your local draft board, an alternative job which you participate for an equivalent of 2 years, totally outside the military establishment. So I decided that I would go the totally non-military route. But again, there was a problem with that. Not the military route, but traditionally back then, or so I understood when I was applying, when I was thinking about becoming a conscientious objector, traditionally the peace churches, the Mennonites and the Quakers, would be granted this. Because in order for you to be granted the status, you had to appear before a local draft board, and they had to decide, yes, you're a conscientious objector, no, you're not. So they were in charge of your fate. So if you were a Mennonite or Quaker, generally you're in good shape. But I was neither, and I just left divinity school, and I didn't go to church. What was I going to do? Well, in researching this, I found out in 1965 a gentleman named Daniel Seeger went before Supreme Court, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and said, listen, I have a firmly held belief that war is immoral, and therefore I deserve a CO status just like my fellow CO who has a conventional God-generated CO status. And they granted that. So I said, great, now I'm in good shape now. I can now apply for a CO and maybe get it because Mr. Seeger's work had allowed me to do that. So I decided to go forward with this. And the CO application is a very lengthy one, and you have to demonstrate that you've been against war for many years, and you have to document all this, and you have to get references. And in the course of that, I discovered a pamphlet which showed me how to apply from a humanist perspective to be a conscious objector. Okay, I'm in good shape now. So I, because I read the Humanist Manifesto, and I said, this makes a lot of sense, and I would be very proud to establish a CEO posture based on the humanist beliefs, which is what I did. So I wrote it with that as my framework and my legitimate road to legitimacy. Okay, so I was sitting there, I got my references, I was all set to go before my draft board, I was all confident, thanks to humanism and Mr. Seeger, that I could be granted this status. Well, guess what? Draft law expired. I was not. So the draft board did not want to talk to me. Again, CEOs are a thorn in their side, so they didn't want to talk to me and dream up anything. So they put me on the back burner. So I decided, well, Randy, do you really believe this stuff, or are you just going to go scot-free and do what you want? So I decided, no, if I really believed in being a conscientious objector, and to make it part of my life, I had to create my own alternative service. So that's, in essence, what I did. I created an alternative service, and I went to work in a mental hospital. And when I went to the mental hospital, when I went as a staff member of the mental hospital, I felt that I could make a larger, again, my thinking, okay, how can I make a larger contribution? Well, I decided when I was working in the mental hospital as an aide that I could make a larger contribution going to graduate school in social work, and that's what I did. So that's the beginning of my journey that comes to this day, and I want to take my pacifism with its humanistic base or legitimacy, and talk about some things that have been I've been struggling with since 1972, when I didn't have to deal with the larger world of the draft. One of them is World War II. And World War II, they always throw that in your face. Okay, World War II, we had to do that, inevitable that we had to do the violent way to deal with Nazism. And that's not true necessarily. There are lots of antecedents to our going into the war that I want to share with you. And I have to give credit to the influence. I found this information through a group called World Beyond War. If you want, after the presentation, I can tell you more about it. It's a great group. It's a pacifist group. Again, the premise for those folks is war has never been justified. And World War II is a classic example of how the world tries to justify war. So let me just tell you some things that I think pacifists need to be out in the forefront telling the world about. There are things that are happening during and before World War II that if we've addressed them directly might have changed the course of events in World War II. So, and bear in mind, Nazis were in power from 1933 to 1945. In 1934, the British, the French, and the U.S. sold tanks and planes to Hitler's Germany. IBM provided machines used to keep the track of the Nazis, of the Jews to be murdered. AT&T sold bomb parts to Germany. The U.S. pilots were told not to bomb factories of U.S. companies in Germany. Particularly when Cologne was bombed, the Ford plant, U.S. plant, that made military equipment for the Nazis was not bombed. In 1940, Hitler made overtures to Great Britain about talking about peace. Hitler said, I'm not talking about that. Pearl Harbor, surprise to us? No, it was not a surprise to us. Well, particularly to FDR. FDR told Churchill, who was the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, the U.S. would provoke Japan to attack the U.S. And he did this by allowing us to build bases in Guam, Midway, and Wake Island, Mid-Pacific, aiming toward Japan. Okay. Now, in terms of the plight of the Jewish refugees, and the horrific treatment of Jews. In 1938, the U.S., Britain, and South American countries met and agreed not to accept Jewish refugees. In 1940, the French ambassador asked the U.S. Secretary of State to accept German refugees in France. Many of course, were Jews. Secretary of State of the U.S. said, no way. In 1942, Anthony Eden, who was the British Foreign Secretary at the time, was talking to U.S. Secretary of State Cordell Hull about the difficulty of asking Hitler for the Jews. The difficult asking Hitler for the Jews was the fact that Hitler might take us up on the offer, number one, and two, there weren't enough ships in the world to handle all the refugees. Well, 2 years earlier, 1940, the British evacuated from Dunkirk. Remember that situation? The Germans were encircling the Allied forces and they had to get them out. So in 1942, they evacuated 340,000 soldiers in 9 days. Okay. In 1939, there was a ship of Jewish refugees going toward Miami, and guess what? U.S. Coast Guard said you can't land, turn around, and they had to go back to Europe. Okay, if you don't want to believe a pacifist source, this is from the Smithsonian Magazine. Their comment about those years, thousands of people from Germany were denied entry to the U.S., and of course, many of them were Jews. Eerily reminiscent of what's happening today, isn't it? And the people were feeling that those refugees would be Nazi spies. FDR in 1940 warned the Jewish refugees were a threat because they could aid Nazis in exchange for their loved ones who were still trapped in Germany. Well, in my mind, that contradicts the dictum that World War II was inevitable. Things could have been done to, I think, change the course of history. Okay, so that's my feeling about pacifism and World War II. Now I'd like to move on to the Middle East and the wars that are happening in the Middle East. Again, I'm trying framing all my thoughts from a humanist perspective. Many of the conflicts have a religious component. Islam is the dominant religion of the region. There are two major sects, the Sunnis and the Shiites. And they share some commonalities, they share some doctrinal and ritual differences. But my understanding of how the original split began was that when Muhammad, the prophet, died, they had to have someone to replace them as a leader. And the Sunnis were a group who wanted that successor to be someone they trusted, someone they knew, a competent person. And they wanted Abu Bakr, who was Muhammad's trusted aide, to be the first successor. The other groups, however, wanted someone in the Muhammad prophet's family. They wanted his cousin Ali to be the next leader. So what happened was the Sunnis won out, and Abu Bakr became the first leader. And eventually Ali got in, and so but they've been back and forth ever since. And the Sunnis pretty much, they're about 90% of the population of the Middle East. The rest are Shiites. So politically, that breaks down into the two major powers, in my mind, are Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Saudis are primarily Sunni, and the Iranians are primarily Shiite. So let's go to some of the countries. Yemen, You've heard about the tragedy in Yemen that's getting worse and worse and worse. Okay, thinking from a religious perspective, the central government is Sunnis, and they're being challenged by a Shiite subgroup known as the Houthis. The central government, supported by Saudi Arabia, of course, because they're Sunnis, fellow Sunnis. And the rebels, Houthis, are supported by Iranians, because the Iranians are Shiites, and the rebel group, Houthis, are primarily Shiites. And, well, guess who we're supporting? Saudi Arabia, and they're Sunnis. So we're siding with the Sunni part of that conflict, because we don't like the Iranians, and the Iranians, of course, are Shiites. So again, we're accentuating the divide from a religious point of view. In Iraq, okay. In Iraq, the central government are Shiites, but Saddam Hussein was a Sunni from a subgroup of the Sunnis, but his group, his family, were Sunnis. So when we got rid of Saddam Hussein, the Sunnis were out of favor. But most of the population of Iraq were then and still are Sunnis. So when the Shiites came into power, of course, we allowed that to happen. We were not very strong in saying, hey, wait a minute, we got to balance this out. Sunnis and Shiites have to be somewhat balanced representative-wise in the government. But that did not happen. And it's still pretty much Shiite-generated work. Governmental agencies are pretty much controlled by the Shiites, and the military is pretty much run by Shiite generals. And we, of course, are supporting the central government. So we're supporting the Shiites. And a lot of the rebel groups, of course, are Sunni. Based, because they don't think they're getting a fair shake. Syria, what's happening in Syria from a religious perspective? Central government, Mr. Assad, is from a subgroup called the Alawites, which are a Shiite majority group. So the Shiites pretty much control the show. The soldiers and the generals are Shiites. And Iran, guess who they back? They, of course, are back the central government, the Shiites. And so do the Russians. I'm not sure why the Russians do that, but they, again, accentuate the divide. And the Sunnis are the majority of the people, but the government's run by the Shiites, so they get the raw end of the deal. And they, of course, most of the rebel groups are generated from the Shiite population, I mean, from the Sunni population. Afghanistan is a little bit different, but it's 90% Sunni, and we, of course, support the central government. And the strongest rebel group are the Talibans, which are primarily Sunni, but because they don't agree with what's happening in downtown Kabul, they're very angry at the United States, of course. So they blame all their problems on the United States because we're strong supporters of the central government. So what would I say is a pacifist humanist response to this? Well, one is don't take sides. There are a lot of groups, media doesn't talk about it, or certainly mainstream media doesn't talk about it, about there's a lot of pro-democratic civilian groups, lots of women's groups who are pushing for women's rights and human rights democracies. And that's who the folks we should be supporting. If not verbally, we could be supporting them financially too. I know that's a stretch, but that's a very strong possibility that we do not take sides, we do not arm. From a pacifist point of view, we do not arm anyone, but if we want to take sides, the sides we take on are the civilian folks, civilian society that's putting their efforts and their lives at risk talking about democracy and women's rights. So I guess I should close, allow anybody to talk about their thoughts or challenge me about this or agree with me about this. And again, thank you for letting me share my journey, because it's as you can see, it's a serious part of my life, and it's affected me a great deal. So
I think you're right about the not picking sides, because the way I look at the Middle East right now, it's almost less religion and more almost gang warfare.
Yeah.
I mean, you could take all definition out of the word Sunni and Shiite, and you still got that gang warfare where, you know, you could call them the spicks and the tags, and they still be almost like a gang warfare. And the minute you start taking sides on a gang warfare, you've sort of lost control of the issue.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, because it becomes much more complex. If it's just religion, you can just deal with that. But you're right; it becomes much more complex, and to take sides is in my mind very short-sighted on the part of the U.S. because it's so sophisticated, and
I mean, it wouldn't work.
We think we know to support Gang X, but Gang X has all sorts of mixed motives because they're a gang. Yeah.
Well, and we do it. There's all kinds of financial incentives for the U.S. because we're the biggest arms dealer in the world. So we're making gobs of money by selling to everybody who'll buy.
Right. Is that perhaps the reason why Trump is abandoning the treaty?
One wonders.
Yeah, that's probably part of it. I mean, by a great margin, the vast majority of exports for the United States are weaponry. By a great margin. I forget exactly how much it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we can sell, you know.
Yeah, so it doesn't pay for us to be making peace, because you make money when you sell weapons. If there's peace, then you don't sell any weapons, and then people are out of work. And
that's that. I agree with that, but research has been done, maybe by folks like Bob Rushline, probably, but also all sorts of folks, that a dollar spent for military is, I'm thinking, but I think if they spend $1 billion for military, you get maybe 120,000 jobs. But if you spend the same amount of money in the civilian sector for healthcare, it's like 130,000-150,000 jobs. So you can create more jobs and make more money by diverting the funds away, but it's a very...
Well, because selling to, putting your money in military goods is not productive, because the end point is something that is not used in the economy.
Right, good point, yeah.
Unless, of course, you happen
to be in war. Right, but it's not something that generates more...
It doesn't go back into the economy, And I think... From a humanist point of view, it says that it's okay to kill people of color. It's not okay to, well, drone warfare is an example. It's okay to kill people with drones because they're in Afghanistan and Iraq. But it's, and so the dignity and worth of individuals that humanists talk about.
I don't think there's so much color. I think it's more that's not where
cultural.
Anybody's going to be looking at it.
I'm sorry?
It's not where anybody's going to be looking at it.
Yeah.
The other thing about the money issue is that, let's face it, if you want to stop immigration to America, you have to go into the other countries and make it a viable place for even the poor people to live. That's the only way you're going to have to stop, it's not the vast majority of immigration. They come here for the money and for the safety and everything else. They don't come here because they don't want to necessarily come here. Some of them do, but not a huge amount.
And a lot of the gangs that have developed in South America are from people that immigrated here, and then we kicked them out. So they learned all that here, and then we sent them home. So. Yeah. And has made it untenable to live in their countries.
Yeah.
I have a question about the selective service system. When that draft law expired, did that mean the conscientious objector was no longer recognized, or is that still something that's part of the law?
Oh, thank you. I'd love to talk about that. Selective service system, you still have to register. But you've never been allowed to state whether or not you're a conscientious objector. You have to...
Up front, you can't.
You have to go to an exorbitant means. I'll tell you what I did. It was even back then, you said you fill out, when you filled out your registration for elective service, there's no, as I said, there's no thing on it to acknowledge that. So what you have to do is you have to send them a separate letter, make sure everything is certified mail, that they have to send you a receipt, because you don't know if they're going to destroy it or what they're going to do. They're not legally bound to do anything because there's nothing on the forms, so they can do everything anything they want. So you have to document from the Selective Service system that they've received your CO status. And now they even make it more difficult for folks because there's no draft. There's no incentive to register. Lots of people are not registering. So what they do now is they can withhold scholarships if you're not registered to go to college. They can, what they do now is, in terms of getting a driver's license, some states you cannot, they will not allow you to fill out the forms unless you notify the draft board that you are registered. So you can't get it. Okay, that's a look. Now they even make it easier for you to register. They'll say, okay, we will contact the draft board for you. But if you say no, we will not give you the forms to allow you to get a driver's license.
Which means you then can't vote.
Which means?
Is that federal or state by state?
It's a federal. Yeah, I've never seen any literature to say it's a state by state. It's a federal law. Because the Pell Grants, one of the Pell Grants is a federal grant. Mm-hmm. So that's a grant that you're not eligible for unless you're registered for the draft.
If you're male.
Yeah, right.
Still male.
Right. So that's a major issue.
But they're trying to change it for both.
Yeah, they're trying.
ERA.
Pardon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can be. Yeah.
That's what was one of the arguments against the ERA.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there was a discussion on PBS we were listening to the other day that was talking about the move to have the registration both male and female for this country.
But back to what you were saying, Randy, one of the other things about the Selective Service system is that the Selective Service boards are required to place you at the lowest category on the list that you are eligible for.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you mean?
1A is you're eligible for military service automatically. 1O is you're an objector.
Right.
4F is clear to the bottom of the list.
Right.
So if you have a disability, you can't be in the statistics of a conscientious objector. If you have a divinity school deferment, you're in. And they don't use deferment, but they still categorize people based upon the lists. And so that keeps the conscientious objector statistics as low as possible.
Right.
Now that my first husband was a 1AO, which meant he was still eligible for the draft, but as a conscientious objector.
Right.
Then he went to school, so he got a deferment. Then we went, left school, they classified him instead of reclassifying him as a 1AO, they classified him as 1A. So of course he objected.
Right.
And there was a period of time in there around 1967 or 68 where the person who was in charge of the program was turning everybody down, including Quakers.
Uh-huh.
You couldn't.
Yeah.
It was an interesting process because first, of course, the FBI had to do a total background check on you. I mean, it wasn't just...
Yeah.
And then...
Been there, done that.
Yeah, and then after that, then you went to your draft board. And in his case, the draft board approved the 1A, but when it got kicked up to the next level, they disapproved it because that guy was turning down everybody, including Quakers and Mennonites, everybody.
Wow.
That was a very interesting I think, relatively short period. I don't know how long that guy was in charge, a couple of years, mm-hmm. but it was a really difficult time because it put people in a terrible position of, you know, do you refuse and go to prison? Do you migrate to Canada? Because they could not get the status that that was in their hearts and which they applied for and got approved for.
And did the work to get.
And were approved for on the draft board level.
Yeah.
So it was a...
So well, when he was referred to the higher level, was he kept as a 1A?
Yeah,
or did he get back to 1A?
No, he was kept as a 1A. Yeah.
So did he ever get drafted?
No, notice? Because at that point, there was the, what, the Kennedy fathers and the... There was a point where, before that, when you got married, you went down on the list.
Right. Yeah.
And then that got thrown out, but when you had children... You went down on the list. So by that time, it must have been 1968, and we had had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So that put him lower on the, and so he never was drafted. And I don't know what he would have done. But there are other people who were in that situation, caught in that catch 22. Yeah.
Well, in my case, the local board denied my request for CO status.
Mm.
So I appealed to the state. They had their hearing, and then they asked for medical documentation on my vision and classified me as 4F.
4F,
So they skipped making a decision.
So in your case, Randy,
what
did
year
the
was that?
Selective Service System ever rule on your application for a CO status?
No.
So you were never officially...
Not in this little period.
No, they put me on. I consider they put me on the back burner. They had some status that they put people of CO qualifications on, and they didn't have to deal with me only because they didn't need me in my local draft board numbers. So as soon as, if they needed me, then I would have to have appeared before them. Yeah, so I was in that wait and see category, and the world was such that I had to create my own if I really wanted to do it, but they weren't needing me to do that. So I think another point I want to make is why, the larger question of course is why don't we as a people become pacifists when we know all this information, and why do we constantly, or are maybe our elected officials constantly support a defense budget? We spend more money than the next 7 countries combined. I mean, that you can't even describe the adjective for that. And why don't we, our elected representatives, do this? I mean, I write to my representatives all the time. They send me nice letters, but it always avoids that issue. Always the militaristic nature of our society, they don't want to touch, at least in my letters. So I guess what I want to make a point to the public is that pacifism talks about large bunches of people arming themselves, killing other human beings. That's what we're against. That's immoral, illegal, and against international law. But that's, and we're saying it's possible to establish that posture in the world. Again, World Beyond War, if anybody wants to talk to me after this presentation, I'll be glad to give you details about how they talk about an pacifist alternative to what we have to maintain, or our representatives feel we have to maintain. So that posture is different from self-defense. Oftentimes you'll say, well, what's a pacifist going to do if you have a gun to your head? Or the other one is, what's your grandmother's have a gun to their head? Pacifists, I have answers to those, yes. But we're not talking about that. You don't discount the relevance of the argument for pacifism at a national scale for issues of self-defense, personal self-defense. And I think that's why I think a lot of people discount that. There's no, anyway, I don't think there's not very much risk to be a pacifist at the national level. I devised personal self-defense. I studied the martial arts as my response to that. And there's lots of situations where a gun was not needed, and the media misportrayed the exact situation. There's lots of situations where maybe guns were necessary, but Anyway.
I will say they also, I mean, media doesn't cover some of the issues with the military, too. My dad got, and I continue getting it, this newsletter called The Project on Government Oversight. And one of its favorite topics is this bomber, which barely works, and they've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars on it. And it still barely works. It drops like one bomb and then breaks apart.
Yeah.
And I was tickled pink. I watched, what's that show with the lady on it?
Amy Goodman?
No. She's talking about
well, she actually,
watch on Sunday night.
It's on Wednesday night. So.
Oh, KCDC?
Oh, maybe this isn't the one.
Is it KCDC you're talking about?
No, I was thinking of Madam
Secretary.
No, it's on Wednesday nights. It's one of those talk shows. I forget what her name is right now. But she actually covered the issue of the bomber that cost billions and barely works, and half the time the person would probably die before he actually bombed something. So there's so much waste going on, and they keep up that project. It almost sounds like the senators continue paying for it because they just like the sound of it.
Well, plus it's giving some congressmen's constituents jobs.
There's that.
And I mean, that's the excuse.
I have seen coverage that late night show, late night with whatever on TBS, and this newsletter, The Project on Government Oversight. That is the only two places I have seen talk about this. National media, you know, even the New York Times, which is pretty good. I don't think I've seen cover it. This country treats the military like, like religion, for God's sake. You're a bad citizen.
About this. We had a government shutdown. You remember that?
Yeah.
So we were watching the Rose Bowl parade. And, of course, NBC stops. We've got to pay attention to the military flyover. And we see the flag. We see all of this advertising. And, of course, all of the expense of the military flyover. So military advertising is an ingrained part of our culture.
I think they do it almost like, as I say, religion. You know, if you argue against it or say something nasty about it, you're probably considered a bad citizen.
The main thing is that there's just so many people who don't have access or don't historically have access to that type of literature, and they believe the constant propaganda that we're getting, that this country, our military is protecting us. They're protecting us from being attacked. They go over in some country nobody's heard of, but they're there to defend our country. Well, it has absolutely nothing to do. But if people are convinced that somebody's knocking at their back door, therefore we have to do the military spending, we have to have the planes, the bombs, and everything, because otherwise they're going to come get us. And it seems like at some point, because we've been hearing this for decades, centuries, that the people would realize that it's not true. That's not the justification for this militarization.
And Kathy so eloquently said, there's no risk involved in taking all our troops away from Afghanistan and Iraq. What do we got to lose? And incredible savings. Think of the money we could save becoming a country that's just self-defense. We just have, anyway, World Beyond War talks about assuming a defensive posture, you know, to pull all our troops out of those bases, the money we saved, and sure, okay, there's evil in the world. We have to acknowledge that. So we'll just, defensive posture. We'll have a defensive, somebody comes in, we'll deal with it, you know, and there's no risk involved. And I think Kathy's saying is people think there is a risk. There's no risk involved. How can you tell me that shooting drones at Afghani civilians is a risk to us?
Also, as you were pointing out with World War II,
there
are other methods of coping with things, too.
Right. We could have said yes to the Jews.
Well, and the problem in World War II was the end of World War I.
Right.
And if we had treated Germany as we did after the Second, the Second World War, we rebuilt Europe. After the First World War, we starved Europe. And we had a totally different posture. And we created the we laid the groundwork
yeah.
for the discontent that yeah. led to the Second World War. If we had done the right thing after the First World War, we would never gotten to the Second World War.
Yes.
So
thank you both for pointing out that reality. It's really true. We laid the, as you said, we laid the groundwork for World War II, and we did. Well, the Allies. We can't say we were by ourselves,
no,
but we had help. But yeah.
But if we had done after World War I, what we did after World War II, which was rebuild Europe,
mm-hmm.
then
we
would have been the world would have been in a whole
different
place.
Yeah.
Is the World Beyond War group David Swanson's
yes,
group?
Yes, David Swanson is the director. And I would urge you to listen to David Swanson. They have World Beyond War has a website. I would urge you to read and listen to. He's a very eloquent man, and he debates people on World War II and debates anything. He'll just show you, as you pointed out, there are other realities that the world needs to know about, which will change your conception of all sorts of things. So, yeah.
There's a radio program.
Yes, thank you, Bob.
His radio program is called Talk Nation Radio, and it's broadcast on WIDE.
Oh, good. I got to listen to your station more.
Do you know if there's anything in the Quakers and humanists getting together and...
Quakers and humanists?
Well, getting together and upping up the conscience. Those two are ones that I know support conscious objection. Supporting that in the draft board thing, getting it on the books better.
I don't know what the humanists are doing. I know the Friends Service Committee is involved in trying to get the Selective Service System abolished. I mean, there's lots of people. There's a group called Conscience and War. And they're advocating for abolishment of Selective Service System, i.e. registering. And I don't know for a fact if the Quakers are involved, but I wouldn't be surprised if they are, because they've maintained that their pacifist posture throughout. I have to give them credit. They've kept militarism as an issue throughout, you know, all the other issues in the world. All of the rest of us kind of wax and wane on. Pacifism has been a very important part of their message, despite all the other things that, you know, all the issues that we talk about and struggle with and contribute to are all intermixed. And the Quakers have been a group that, in my mind, have kept militarism as part of that mix, and very few other groups have. Very few. They don't, as you were saying, it's a religion, and nobody wants to touch that.
It's actually hard. I mean, sometimes even I quaver around the notion of, you know, police action for rescuing some of those girls who get kidnapped and sold into slavery. So, it is a hard stance to actually live by.
Yeah.
Well, my cousin was a Quaker and was a CO in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
and he did his service by working for the Syracuse Peace Council.
Yes,
which I thought was just wonderful.
Yeah,
I was amazed that they let him do it as an alternate service, but they
may have been very assertive and said, "Listen, I've got this position. Can I do it?" So he did the work, and my sense is
undoubtedly. Yeah.
I'm so sure, fine, because they don't want, you know, obviously they didn't want to do the work to find a job, because they don't believe in COs, so asking them to find a job for a CO is way beyond their desires.
And that probably was in 1965,
yeah,
so it was earlier than this,
yeah.
you know, the total war stance.
Yeah.
And some of us remember Lee Bowen, who was
yes.
member of the Prairie, and who was a conscious objector. He was involved as doing experiments on what was it, testing medical drugs or something?
He was
a CO service.
Patient.
He was a testy.
A patient?
Testy,
oh, right. Yeah.
And became deaf as a result. Lost his hearing from the testing.
Yeah.
At least on one side.
Yep.
And then there was John Grimrod, who was a CO in World War II, whose wife was Jewish.
Yeah.
And so her family had, you know, was for the war because of, Hitler rescuing the Jews.
Yeah.
So that was an interesting dynamic in that, you know, on the family level. Right?
Sure.
So.
Sure.
I don't quite see how we can distinguish. If you talk about conscientious objector, you're talking about the big picture. Without taking it down to the individual level, or is violence ever justified, and under what circumstances it is. I think, if I understand it correctly, the conscientious objector means you would not take the life of another person in any circumstance.
No, conscientious objector means you do not want to participate in military service in the service of war. It does not say anything about self-defense, technically speaking. But
that's
you're right.
A big confusion.
But it made, no, you allude to a great confusion. Yes, Gary.
Where do you move from the individual justification to the mass justification? There's a continuum there.
Well, cutting butter with a chainsaw analogy. You deal with your personal situation and you stop it. You don't bludgeon the person to death, or you don't shoot them four times. If your only recourse is a gun, which has proven to be not very effective, other means of defense have been proved to be more effective. That's how I would couch the argument. It's you do what you need to do to extinguish the situation for your safety, and maybe it involves hurting another person, but maybe it doesn't. And I think that's one reason I learned some self-defense skills, because I was conscious of that awareness. I wanted to be able to do something to make myself safe, but not bludgeon the other person. And I think that's the rule, is you do what's necessary, and you don't, that doesn't negate pacifism at a national level, because you did what was necessary given the realities of that situation and how you saw them. And Lord knows, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't second guess anybody's self-defense modality. Except a gun, I'm not crazy about carrying guns, but I think there are other things you can do.
Like non-lethal weapons.
Yes, non-lethal weapons, using your talented voice. And all of that takes practice. Having self-defense skills, using a non-lethal weapon, takes practice. And I think that's an issue. People just want, okay, I'm going to pull out a gun, I'm going to defend myself, okay, and then that legitimates having military. And I think, for me, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if you want to be consistent with your beliefs, you have to train yourself, you have to learn, you have to teach, you have to educate yourself. And I don't think the general public is willing to do that. They just want to have a gun. And I mean, it theoretically, if you were well trained with a gun, you could defend yourself pretty gently. But no, people just want the gun, and they just want to. How I look at it, I mean, if I would want to be a gun owner, I'd be willing to. Well, like they do in Japan and Australia, there are immense rules that you have to go through to possess a gun. And if I was really sincere about needing the gun for self-defense or just skill, I would be willing to train, I'd be willing to have a waiting period, I'd be willing to show people my skill, which you have to do in Australia and Japan. But then we're not willing to do that. We just want a concealed weapon permit, put it in our pocket, and walk down the street. I think that's a problem. You got to be willing to be trained if you want to carry it, like driving a car. And Alice driving a car. We're all willing to put up with that. I think carrying a gun, if that's the mode of self-defense you choose, I wouldn't choose it, nor would I encourage anybody else to choose it, but you should be well-trained. That's like learning self-defense that I learned. I've spent years learning how to do that.
So. Now, there are people who are pacifists who have the stance that Gary just described.
Yes,
them,
yes. Good, thank you.
Will
yes.
not,
yes.
Even in the matter of self-defense.
Yes. Yes.
And that's where the draft boards would have trouble, because they think of that stance versus the national stance and easily get it confused. But it doesn't mean that there aren't people who have exactly the stance that you described, Gary.
Pacifists with different levels of commitment.
Different levels of pacifism.
Right, right.
Yeah, be it local,
and they're all,
state.
and all legitimate. Like I, as I said, I wouldn't second guess a self-defense pacifist who has that posture that I got to have a violent form of defense. You know, yeah.
I still have problems seeing where you draw the line.
And I think that's a very personal level.
Yeah.
I'm sure you can say that a lot of bad things about military establishment, how we're doing things, but at what point? You say, it is a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And even at the personal level, as you've indicated, the motivation for your, what you call self, somebody calls self-defense may be suspect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And where do you draw the line? Say, well, this is okay and that isn't.
Yeah, it's tricky.
The important part is we continue to talk about it, to make it an issue, I think. For me, that's the bottom line for this discussion and for any discussion, to make that a discussion and for not to be sacred or taboo. Because if we don't talk about those individual choices, we can't really educate for the larger issues either. They'd be open to talk, which humanists are, that's one reason humanism helped me. They've allowed me to talk, encouraged me to talk. And to say it's not, it's just, you know.
Mentioning David Swanson, he has an article in the Humanist magazine that I was just reading this morning. It's sitting over on the bookshelf.
Okay.
Yeah. One thing that struck me when there was a police killing in Madison and there was news coverage, and I don't know whether the news coverage was taken out of context, but it sounded like the police training sergeant that they were interviewing was saying, a fist is as dangerous as a bullet. And then they were showing police in training who would be approached by someone with fists and they take two steps back and draw their gun. And that's just crazy in my point of view. You can't equate a fist with a gun unless the gun only shoots as far as the length of your arm.
Right. Good point. And I think for me that points to the importance of police training.
Right.
You know, and they should be skilled in all sorts of ways of defending themselves. And I agree with you that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Any other questions for Randy? If not, thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you for having me.